to Gonkcast, an Autechr podcast. I'm Gabe.
I'm Dan.
And this is yet another bonus episode about your emails. Plus, I know we're jumping ahead a little bit, but we'll spend some time discussing Autechr's 2021 remix of Sophie's 2013 classic, Bip. We've been trying to save all of Autechr's remix work for a special episode or two after we finish the main discography, but we thought we'd give this one special treatment because it's kind of the only extra AE release in the Sign Plus era so far, and plus, it's Sophie, so, you know. On that note, our next episode, one week from now, will be on Autechr's most recent album, Sign and Plus. We've gotten a handful of emails so far, but we want way more, and we know you've all got some thoughts to share, so gonkcastpod@gmail.com. That email address is in the show notes of every episode. All right, Dan, what background info do we need to know about Autechr's remix of Sophie's Bip?
Yeah, Bip, which was first released on June 17th, 2013, was Sophie's breakout single, and it reached even more listeners as the lead track on her celebrated compilation album, Product, from 2015. I'm sure everyone knows the story by now, but when Sophie's label asked her about commissioning remixes to promote the album, she replied, "No remixes unless it's Autechr." Her label spent years trying to make this happen, but got no response until 2020, when an email from Autechr randomly showed up with a WAV file attached and the message, "Sorry this is so late, hope it's still of some use." The remix was packaged with a previously unreleased B-side and released digitally January 14th of 2021. The vinyl edition shipped on January 28th, which was just 2 days before Sophie's tragic death at the age of 34.
Yeah, so the remix has taken on an extra level of poignancy because of this tragic timing, but beyond that, it doesn't seem particularly well-liked. It's currently sitting at a not-great 2.88 out of 5 on Rate Your Music, and we actually decided to do this episode after getting an email from listener Marco, who writes, "Can I just say that I was very unimpressed by their Bip remix? They seem to have missed the point of every part of Sophie's sound, and the track feels like a rejected Incunabula-era cut." Marco also shared some Sign and Plus opinions more recently, which we'll save for the main episode, obviously, but he couldn't help but add, "I renew my hatred for the Sophie remix that I talked about in my previous email. How the hell did that happen?" So let's talk about Sophie's original track first. How would you describe it, and what makes it so special, if indeed you do think it is so special?
I do think it's special. You know, I'm not a big fan of the whole, like, bubblegum bass hyper pop thing, but you know, I understand it. I get why people like it, and it is interesting. And I think that this track is like a fantastic example of that. The producing, like the music, is really great. It honestly sounds like an Autechr track. It's really nuts and stuff. And then, you know, the vocals are sort of where it loses me. It's you know, too sugary and sweet for me. But it's a pretty like crazy track. You know, the percussion is all like sort of, I'm beating around not mentioning Autechr's remix first, but the like percussion in the Sophie track is all like sort of like no hi-hats and stuff. You know, it's all sort of like lasery,
like missing. Most
yeah,
of it
yeah,
is
yeah.
Missing.
Exactly, and it gives it like this sort of like real weird kind of flow. It's like, I don't know, kind of like wet and lasery.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's got like a very striking, and yes, you know, I think you're right to compare it to the kind of like sound design we, you know and love from Autechr. But it's just like this, the sound at the core of the thing is like this weird, like I want to call it kind of rubbery and squeaky, but also something like a drill sound or something. It's just like this very arresting sound. And it's such a minimal track because that is like the core and like the center stage thing, just almost like this lone, you could call it a bass line or something. And then, yeah, very sparse percussion. Of course, you know, you mentioned the kind of pitched up vocal that also gets like chopped at certain points. And it has like this very, you know, this sounds like a Madonna track or something. It's got like this, it's so like infectious and poppy, and it's, I don't know, it's got sort of like the, what I like so much about this is like, it's got this kind of energy of like a house anthem or something. Like the way the vocals are used are the kind of thing that just, it just gets you so hyped, you know, if you're in the club or something. But the track is so sparse and so minimal, but it somehow has this like weird potential energy to it. You know, like it just feels like a, like what is the least amount of components that we could use to create like an absolute everybody runs to the floor kind of banger. You know, I it's almost like magic, like lightning in a bottle, how it accomplishes that.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it is like something that would be really awesome in the club, but you're right. It's like everything that's unnecessary in any way is like completely stripped. You know, it's like minimalism to a degree. You know, it's just the bare bones of you know what's necessary to make the track that way, and it works like surprisingly well, and like very well actually. You know,
yeah, and it kind of makes it like even more hype than it would be, like just the fact that nothing's there. I don't know what the, it's like almost hard to describe, and I sort of agree that it is kind of classic. And I'll kind of admit that I don't think I'd heard this song like back when it came out or something, when it was like getting all this buzz, but never really returned to it. And like I'm almost ashamed to admit that I've never really gotten into Sophie, and now it feels like it's too late because it's like too depressing actually to listen to Sophie's music. Like I missed the boat or something. But you know, listening to it just feels like an instant classic. Like I totally understand why it has the reputation it does. Now, the question is, what did Autechre do to it for the remix? Like, how would you describe their treatment of it?
You know, I sort of feel like Autechre made it more normal. Like if you took, if I didn't know, you know, if I had never heard either of these, you know, tracks, and you played them both to me and said which one was the Autechre remix, I would pick the original, like 100%.
That's a good point.
Because they pitch the vocals down a little bit. They're a little deeper.
Yeah.
Or I think they're even just slower. And then they add hi-hats and sort of like more normal percussion. I mean, it's still like not, it's, you know, it's not a four on the floor, you know, like normal dance groove or something. You know, the hi-hats are still like sort of weird. They do that like sort of rolling, almost like trap sort of thing. So it's definitely interesting, but I feel like they just kind of add what the previous song is like missing, but missing in a way that makes that song so interesting.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I mean, it still stays like very, very sparse, and it somehow feels like, I saw a lot of people sort of describe this as like a stripped down version of Sophie's track, which seems wrong, but also right, because it's sort of like, removes like that kind of, you know, potential energy that you know would bring everybody to the dance floor with Sophie's original, and it turns it into this kind of, I don't even know if it's slower, it just feels slower. It's certainly pitched down and it might be a little bit slower, but it just feels like slower. The tom, there's like kind of this tom roll that's just kind of these tumbling toms, and then there's like a much heavier kind of low end groany kind of like bass line, you know, over the thing, and it just adds like this heavy kind of lumbering weight that I do sort of associate with a lot of Autechre's recent work. Like we're always talking about with these last couple of records, you know, like just how massive the sound is and how, like, you know, it's got that kind of quality. And it also has the kind of like unquantized quality that I associate with Autechre of this period, where it's like, you know, the toms are kind of like tumbling in this almost organic, like living, breathing way, and it doesn't feel like just a loop, you know, it feels like the track is like kind of this like rolling, groaning kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I can't help but agree that it like weirdly, you know, this listener who wrote in, listener Marco, like sort of argued that they like missed the point of what made Sophie's original track brilliant. And I'm so torn about it, because it feels like, yes, they sort of sucked out that like weird potential kinetic energy thing that's like, you know, just driving the whole track. And yet they also seem to have realized you can't add too much. It still needs to be sparse. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's kind of a weird track to pick. You know, I mean, I'm not a Sophie aficionado or anything, but I just feel like, you know, the original here is just sort of like a perfect track. I don't see how you could improve on it, you know, because of that like potential energy, and it's just something that's so like it's such like a unique song that I feel like it would be so difficult to like remix that and make it better in any way. And so I'm sure there's a you know, less good Sophie track or something that they maybe could have improved on or something. I don't know. It just seems like sort of a weird pick. But I mean, you know, I guess it is sort of her most famous song too. So maybe that's the only one they knew to do or something. I don't know. It's a little weird.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like a bold choice to pick this track. You know, and it feels like maybe the intention was to make, you know, it's got this kind of like late night version quality of, you know, to the track where it's almost like it's got like this kind of spacier quality. You know, it feels like, I don't know, you could probably still dance to it, but it just feels like this kind of thing where you would like, I don't know, just like listen deep into all the empty space now instead of like, you know, jump to your feet and start dancing. You know what I mean? It's kind of like what they were going for was the late night flip side.
Yeah, like the club's closing now, you know, we're playing it on the way out, or, you know, last song of the night, kind of, you know, wind down sort of thing. I can see that.
Yeah, and then the weird thing is, like, I mean, obviously this is, it's almost unfair to, like, burden the remix with this, but the whole circumstances of Sophie, you know, dying so close to the release of this track, it's like, I don't know, it just has, like, a, like, am I adding this? It's got, like, kind of a somberness to it, or just kind of, like, a mellowness that just feels, like, a little bit sad, you know, that almost feels, like, fitting in a weird way. Did you get that at all?
I mean, I, obviously, like, it's being added because, you know, they didn't know she was gonna die,
right,
you know, and if they did, they should have done something. But you know, I think it's easy to, like, you know, add things like that, but I think also, like, her death has maybe brought, like, much more attention to this, you know, remix than it maybe would have gotten before. You know, it may be that's a little unfair too, you know. I mean, I'm sure Ottaker probably didn't intend to make it, you know, a much better track, you know. That seems kind of dickish to, like, you know, purposely one up somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So now, you know, it maybe feels like it's gotten unfair, you know, unfairly put into the spotlight.
Yeah, the expectations are pretty high, and I mean, that's kind of what I wanted to close on, is like, why does it seem like Sophie fans don't like it, but also Ottaker fans don't seem to like it? You know, if listener Marco is anything to go by, but I just feel like this is the prevailing sentiment that I've seen. So, like, you know, it might be as simple as that, right? That there's just, like, undue expectations on this track to, you know, be, like, some kind of, you know, I don't know. You just think about, like, two juggernauts, like Sophie and Ottaker, kind of colliding. You expect sparks to fly, and so maybe you'd be disappointed anyway. But the fact that it just feels like this final, you know, look at her work or something, and, like, these sort of godfathers of experimental electronic music, like, you know, working with kind of the most exciting new voice, obviously tragically cut short, but in the same sphere, it just feels like it ought to be bigger than it is, but maybe it's just not even fair. Like, why does it have to be such a big statement?
Yeah, I think if, you know, if nothing had happened and this just came out and Sophie was still alive, I think people would just be like, ah, yeah, it was maybe a little disappointing. And then it would just be forgotten, like, you know, millions of other remixes in the world, you know. It just would be a thing. If you liked it, cool, you know. If you collect Sophie stuff or Ottaker, you know, vinyl, you know, maybe you'd pick it up. I mean, it's like, I love the band Tortoise, I love Ottaker, they did a you know, a thing together, and when I first heard about that, I was like, oh, but that's gonna be awesome. And it's just okay. But, you know, Tortoise is still working. So it's just sort of like, you know, I own it, but I don't listen to it that much. And it's just sort of like, you know, disappointing, but whatever, you know. And I think it would have gotten that treatment, except, like you said, it is sort of this, like, unfairly, like, last look sort of thing. I mean, especially not only, like, did she die, but she you know, dies at the peak of her career, you know, fairly young and stuff, you know. It really does put, like, I think undue kind of pressure on this remix, especially, I mean, with that, like, you know, little blurb I read from her where she specifically, you know, says she only wants an Ottaker remix. I think, you know, that adds just another little you know, unfortunate spotlight on it.
Yeah So, I mean, is that, I guess, sounds like kind of our final word on this is it might be a little bit disappointing. That might have to do with a lot with the circumstances and everything. There's some interesting things about it, but it's not like, you know, it doesn't need to have all these eyes on it. That obviously is inevitable.
Yeah, exactly. It should just be, you know, what a remix is generally considered for, you know, fans of, you know, pretty big fans of the original artist, or, you know, maybe of the remix artist. And it's sort of getting the eyes of, everyone who's even like a casual fan of either of the two, which is, you know, unfair.
All right. Well, on that note, let's get into the email, starting with some 1-6 stuff. After complaining that we weren't lucky enough to hear from anybody who attended any of the 2016/2018 shows, we got two emails from attendees with totally opposite perspectives. So you want to read the first one, Dan?
Yeah. Listener Ken attended the 2018 Dublin show and wrote, "The gig was perfect for me. They were there were nervous vibes before the gig, people not knowing if they could handle being stuck in a seat, but it turned out to be the perfect heady experience without the distraction of pissed up ravers thrashing around in a packed club. The set felt beautifully refined, like a seamless 80-minute composition. The venue was such a treat, fully seated with no access to a bar once the show started and no booze allowed in the room. Ushers were there to lead folks to the bathroom in the dark. There were gigantic organ pipes behind their setup that were fucking awesome to see towering behind the lads." And Ken also attached a great picture of the concert hall for us. "Even though they were not in use, it would have been resonating nicely. The room had an array of faint blue lights on the ceiling that gave off some subtle ambiance over the complete blackness. I had scored a balcony seat on my own with a few seats free beside me. Shoes came off instantly. Lush. It was an incredibly immersive set. Took a long time to come down off that experience. The physicality of the sound was amazing."
Yeah, and on the other hand, listener Tom attended a 2016 show at the Royal Festival Hall in London and wrote, it's a little long, but I want to read the whole thing because it's very interesting. He says, "I was really stoked for this gig, perhaps excessively. LSEC had reignited my love of the band, and I was super excited to hear new material in a more comfortable setting. Even though they've performed in the dark for a long time, the pitch black experience was really being pushed, with the RFH sending emails saying that if you needed to leave in the middle, you would have to hold up your ticket and ushers with night vision goggles would escort you out. When it came down to it, that particular aspect of the experience was rather underwhelming. The green exit signs over each door were still on. I was sat behind the mixing desk, which was, of course, lit up like a Christmas tree. The ushers turned out to have blue torches, and so many people were getting up and leaving that it was very distracting and not the amazing sensory experience I had hoped for. Musically, I also found it disappointing. Although, as you said, it was designed for seated listening and full of depth and detail. Typically for AE, it was hard to grasp in one listen and without any obvious beats, rhythms, or melodic sections to grasp onto. I felt it mostly just drifting over my head. Some of it was cool, but when the beats finally kicked in, it was an incredible relief and joy, and it really felt as though the whole audience finally sat up at that point and went, hell yes, here we go. And then the organ blasts were phenomenal, just huge, loud, solid, heavy, dense, textural blasting out of nowhere, like being run over by a train in the night. It felt like they had conjured some never-before-heard sound to pummel us with. And then that ended, and it went back to airy, unfocused drifting. I know a couple of people who were more positive at the time, but I definitely went in expecting a more typical upbeat set, which undoubtedly colored my appreciation. I'll still run, not walk, to get tickets for any future AE live shows." So what do these first-hand accounts reveal? Do they give you any kind of new perspective on the 1-6 sets that we talked about last episode?
I guess it's not surprising that people would have, you know, these are kind of the two reactions I would expect. You know, you either gonna love it or, you know, I don't want to say hate it, but you know what I mean? You know, maybe not be so fond of it. So no, it doesn't surprise me you know, too much. I think maybe the venue has a lot to do with it. I mean, like the second person said, you know, the their venue wasn't so dark and all, and I kind of had the same experience when I saw them. It was at this, like, basically a dive bar, and the front and where the crowd is, all the lights were off there, but on the bar itself, like, the lights were still on so the bartenders could see, you know, so it wasn't pitch black. It was just sort of, you know, a little dark and all. And I'm, you know, I think it would have been much better had it been, you know, pitch black and stuff. And then I think even more so with, you know, the 1-6 set. And then, yeah, same way in a seated environment, you do get that, like, annoyance of, like, people getting up to go to the bathroom or, you know, moving around, yeah, getting a snack or, you know, some shit. And I can imagine, you know, flashlights, that, you know, that's pretty shitty. That'll take you out of the darkness, you know, real quick. You know, that doesn't seem like the, you know, peak, you know, viewing experience. Although I'm glad they left the exit signs on, because that would be a hazard if they turned those off.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, it's sort of revealing to me because, like, first off, you know, we talked about how this tour was primarily, like, going through seated concert halls. but I didn't think to look any of them up. And then, you know, this listener sent us this picture of that Dublin space, and it's like this beautiful.
Oh, I mean, it
it's
was like kind of place so where, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this like amazing looking organ. And it's just like, it's so like classy, you know, it's like the kind of place where you would see like classical music. And in fact, the, you know, I went ahead and looked up where this other person in London saw this show, and it's not like as nice, I think. It's like a little more modern, but it's similar, you know, it's like very, very classy joint. And, you know, so that was kind of revealing, because you would think that that would kind of like put you in the right headspace, you know, like maybe you buy tickets and you're like, wow, they're playing there, you know, that's kind of weird. I wonder what that's going to be like, you know, that kind of classy place. But it still kind of forces you to be like, all right, I'm looking at it like a proper concert. Like, this is like watching a Stockhausen performance or something. I better get ready for that. But, you know, you can still kind of imagine how delicate that situation is, you know, because I've seen like classical shows, right? And it's so, I don't want to use the word pretentious, because I think it's still cool, but it's just like, everybody knows, like, if you have to like cough, like, get the fuck out, you know, like, don't even like, don't ruin anything, you know, for anybody. It's just got that kind of like weird weighty atmosphere. And so this ends up being in like this weird halfway point where you probably have a lot of people that were drinking, so they got to go to the bathroom over and over again. Like, they didn't know they were going to a classical concert exactly. I also thought on that note, it was interesting that, like, you know, the second listener here, listener Tom, attended a 2016 show, and maybe by 2018, where the first listener, you know, saw them, you might have had more word of what you were in for. You know what I mean?
Like,
you might have
that's true.
Had a better idea. You know, so, and this listener, Tom, sort of admits being a little bit surprised by, you know, the lack of beats and stuff. And so probably everybody in the audience had a similar experience. I don't know. I just sort of like reading these emails, I thought they were really great. And it just made me think of like how delicate these sets are. Like, it feels like you really got to be in the right place, and you got to hope there's nobody annoying around you.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing, I don't know if it's like this, you know, overseas, but here in America, those kind of venues, they always have like, you know, rich people who like donate to it. And then you get, you get like tickets to every event that comes there. And so you always have like, you know, old people that just go to everything, and they don't know what it is. Like, a place like that around here, I saw Neutral Milk Hotel there, which was a very odd choice of a venue. But yeah, I mean, there were like, literally there was like some, you know, 70-year-olds in there that just have tickets. And so they decided to go, you know, and like, I can imagine that there's at least some people there that maybe like really don't know what they're getting into. And then, you know, would be super annoying about leaving and getting up and everything. Because you're right, you know, like, you know, in the classical concert or something, you know, people there, like, they sort of know the rules. And then, you know, something like Autechre, it skirts that line of like, you know, classical and you know, a pop concert or something. So it's like the rules of that aren't so clear, you know, and you're gonna get some annoying people, I think.
Yeah, it just seems like really, really precarious. And then, you know, the last thing that I thought was interesting, which we talked plenty about, but just like that this, you know, listener Ken, who went to the Dublin show, you know, the crescendo is at the end, basically. And this other listener, Tom, talks about,
yeah,
you know, how weird it was, honestly, to have the crescendo in the middle. And you know, when you're listening to it on headphones, you think like, wow, what a surprise. Like, what a shock that these like big crescendos sort of come out of nowhere. And then we like move back into the drift. But I guess in a live setting, you, and even especially if you like weren't expecting this kind of like concert hall experience, you would be like, all right, here we go.
Yeah,
and then
yeah,
it would just be like crushing disappointment at the end. So yeah, I mean, it just seems like sort of an interesting experiment, honestly, for Autechre to do this. I wonder if they will do another kind of concert hall, tour, but, all right. Oh, yeah. There was another thing I wanted to read real quick. The listener Ken attached this 2018 interview with the Irish Times, which shed some light on their love for possibly preferential treatment of Dublin, which we talked about last time. Did you take a look at that?
Yeah, I did. I read it. It was pretty interesting. We should, you know, link that on Twitter or the show notes or something. It was like really kind of funny. Like, I think it was Sean saying that he used to go there a lot with his like grandfather, you know, when he was a kid and stuff. And so, you know, he sort of has a love for it, and the, you know, kind of shit talks America a little bit. Saying,
I love that. I love that. Yeah. I wanted to bring that up. Like, they shit talk America all the time. And they were like literally saying like, I don't think we could have done this tour in America.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
like, Americans wouldn't be patient enough. But yeah. So I thought that was really funny, but all
yeah,
right.
Yeah, he said, like, we needed a Mick Jagger on stage, which Mick Jagger is British, so
yeah,
it doesn't
to
even
be
work.
Fair, Sean.
To be fair,
to
yeah.
be fair, you guys invented Mick Jagger.
Not us.
all right, what's next?
Okay, yeah, we got a related email from listener Dan, who says, when you listen to 1/6 very, very loud, it becomes a different beast entirely. This might recreate the live experience and makes it much less ambient and more aggressively immersive. It also makes it a little easier to notice hidden melodies and textures.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this plenty, and I just thought it was like sort of a nice afternote, because I also liked the very end of listener Ken's description of the Dublin show, where he said the physicality of the sound was amazing. And, you know, it just, I wish I had the opportunity. I hope to have it sometime soon, where it's just like I can listen to this really, really loud, so it does feel physical. You know, I do feel like that would add so much to the experience.
Yeah, next time you're down here, let's we'll set up the PA and we'll pretend. Yeah, we'll pretend we're at an Autechre show.
Yeah, our wives will love that.
Yeah, they can sit outside or something.
Okay, now onto some NTS stuff. We got a handful of emails about Shim Ripple Casual specifically. First, I like that listener Sean wrote, "I love that Dan keeps saying shrimp casual. We've all been thinking it." And he added a shrimp emoji. In an earlier email, listener Sean also wrote, "Shim Ripple Casual is so badass and easily one of the highlights of the four sessions. It's deceptively simple, has just the right amount of dark energy, and totally earns its 24.5 minutes. The variations are endlessly entertaining." Listener Tyler also shared these thoughts. "I think Shim Ripple is pronounced Shimmer Ripple, which is an apt description. The underlying ambient sounds seem to just shimmer like the surface of a lake, and the distorted, blown-out bassy synths disrupt that surface and send out a ripple. He calls it a contender for his favorite AE track ever and says it seems like a grown-up version of the idea that motivated Flutter, a track that sounds as if it repeats but never actually does. I think all of the distortions that interrupt the ambient background are unique, but it sounds as if you're hearing the same thing over and over unless you pay close attention. I think you mentioned in your episode on the Anti-EP that Flutter seemed to be a breakthrough idea for the band at the time, and I think this is more evidence of that." So yeah, I mean, lots of love for Shim Ripple Casual, and I think useful actually to reflect back about that Flutter breakthrough that we talked about so long ago in regard to Shim Ripple Casual.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's, you know, really shows that Flutter was, you know, sort of a key opening up like a new stage in their career.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, yeah, I do feel like the more I thought about getting all these emails that were like specifically just like gushing over Shim Ripple, I mean, I love that track as well. Always have. And I started thinking about it, like, it could be a contender for, like, one of the best Autechre songs ever, because it is so masterful how it's, like, it's so long, but it's endlessly entertaining. We talked about this, you know, probably enough on the episode itself, where it was just, like, you're just, like, so excited for each new iteration of that, like, rippling sound, you know, that was, like, mm-hmm. sort of bass bomb thing. And so it sort of, like, nails that, repetition, but just endless variation. Actually, I think the next email is kind of like on the same topic. So you want to read that one?
Yeah, it is, comes from listener Tyler, who says, "Tracks with heavy repetition, such as Acid When Idle, Shim Ripple, not Shrimp, Casual, Easter Hub, Recurry, and All In remind me of the phrasing on one of Eno's oblique strategy cards, namely, repetition is a form of change. I wonder how many of these cards, if any, influenced Autechre. But much of their recent work seems to embody that card, especially because they show how repetition can itself create patterns in the listener's brain. I loved your comment that listening to All In makes you question which changes are real and which ones are just something your mind made up to explain away the repetition, creating the inability to distinguish between real and imagined changes in the listener is an amazing feat of engineering on AE's part."
Yeah, it's kind of got me thinking about, you know, it's weird because like repetition is something that I think Autechre is heavily associated with, and I would say that a lot of their earlier work like really embraces repetition, mm-hmm. like to another level beyond like any of their peers. And yeah, you get to this point in their career and it's much more of that Flutter approach, I think, where it's like, they almost never just repeat things. You know what I mean? Like we are always talking about how it's like, they're kind of chasing this like living, oozing kind of environment of sounds, you know what I mean? Where it's like, no, it's kind of like Shim Ripple Casual, where it's like each iteration of this thing is going to be new. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like they actually never use repetition anymore, like straight up repetition.
Yeah. I mean, it's way more interesting too, because I think, you know, on, you know, just casual listening or something, you probably would just say, you know, it is repetition or whatever, but you're right. You know, when you look deeper into it, you can see that, you know, it is always like living and breathing and something's changing and moving. And it's that, you know, flutter approach again.
Yeah. And then I also wanted to sort of note that, you know, it's funny how like Shim Ripple Casual, it seems like sort of an unassuming piece. I mean, it sort of like comes before All End and maybe even gets overshadowed by All End a lot, even though I know a lot of people love it. But it's just funny how it's like, it's such a key part of the 1-6 set that I was just like reflecting like, yeah, you know, over the last like 4 weeks, I've listened to Shim Ripple Casual like 100 fucking times. You know?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
It's actually like a really important track in their discography, like reaching Flutter levels of importance.
Yeah, that's crazy. I didn't think about that.
All right. So Tyler also shares this theory. He says, my theory about the Casual, Air, etc. track titles is that they name patches / environments based on their sound. For example, they might have a patch called Pendaloo, Dummy, Sinistrail, Clustro, etc. And types of algorithms that they apply to those patches that affect the way they unfold, like Casual, Idle, etc. So a track like Pendaloo Casual might be the Pendaloo patch run through the Casual set of algorithms. I'm sure Rob and Sean would laugh at how wrong I am if they heard this. They probably would, but I feel like it's kind of a decent theory. And it just sort of got me thinking, like, they must do that, right? They must have like components for other tracks and just like swap them to see what happens, and maybe like really interesting things happen.
Yeah, I think it's a, you know, decent theory. I could definitely see that.
Would it be like disappointing to you if like that's all that some of these tracks were like this track's, you know, sequencing attached to this other track's, you know, sounds, and that's a new track, you know?
No, because like, you know, they came up with those you know, environments and everything, and you know, it say they came out and they, you know, they heard this and they said, damn, you're right, you know, nail on the head. It wouldn't really change, you know, like it took this long for someone to figure it out, you know what I mean? It's not like, you know, it's the same song, but this time they used a acoustic guitar instead of a regular guitar, you know, something like that.
Yeah,
kind of,
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, and you have to imagine that like sometimes the way the sounds would interact with like the other programming and the sequencing and the patch or whatever would like be wildly different. Like it would just create like really weird, you know, ricocheting events. And I doubt that they would just, you know, be like dumping out everything like recombined, you know. They probably pick like, oh, this one's actually exceptionally good.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, what's next?
All right, one more from Tyler. It says, you mentioned that in Ikari, it seems like the violent beat-driven breakdown of something like Veovic is always threatening to break through. I actually think that the album consists of a long battle over who will win, the aggressive blown-out beats or the ambient atmospheric undertones. In the first half of the album, the ambient sound threatens to break through the beats, while in the latter half, the beats threaten to break through the ambiance. He also adds a great breakdown of how this plays out in each session.
Yeah, I thought this was super interesting, like thought-provoking, because it got me thinking about how we talked about the importance of NTS3 and like tying everything together. And I think you can hear some of this once you get there. Like you hear this kind of battle between the ambience and the like aggressive, like, you know, there's a lot of like really danceable, like high energy stuff on NTS1, for example. And you can start to like reflect back on the journey as a kind of back and forth in which, you know, maybe ambient wins in the end, or maybe it's just that it's like two halves of the two, you know, sides of the coin or whatever. But it's just so funny to think about like how you would never get this, I think, if you just listen to like NTS 1 and 2, right? Because like NTS 1, it's like it ends in kind of peaceful ambience, you know, the way that like 4 of 7 sort of transitions into like 32A reflected. It's just like this peaceful kind of like cool down. And then we talked about on NTS 2, a lot of those kind of like ambient kind of interlude-y tracks, they feel like these connective tissue almost. Like it feels like the cool down after Volvoik or whatever. I feel like we pronounce this differently every single time.
Yeah, I know.
That's okay. But you know what I mean? It feels like the cool down, another one's like the warm up, you know? And then it's like by the time you get to 3 and then obviously 4, you then kind of realize that there was this back and forth going on, but you would never have, that would never have registered just listening to 1 and 2, you know what I mean?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think that really speaks to, you know, this being like a singular project, you know, even being split into 4 parts, you know, it's definitely, I think you definitely need to like experience as a whole, you know. That doesn't mean sit and listen to it for 8 hours at once. But I think you like, you should never, no one should ever like have only heard NTS1 or NTS3, you know, you should have heard all four, and probably in order.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I just think it's a great example of how like the full experience gives you that kind of bigger picture of like maybe the struggle between two approaches going on. But it's just so funny to like sort of think back, like if you were listening to like NTS1 and you got to 32 or you reflected and you're like, okay, all right, a cool down at the end. This was really nice. You know, you would just never have imagined like
what
this
to come,
vibe yeah, is going to like swallow the entire rest of the thing eventually. All right, so next one is from listener Steve, who notes that he likes to go back and forth between our podcast and Spotify to listen to the tracks, and he wonders how many microcents we've earned for Autechre overall for all of the listeners who are following along with streaming services. I wonder, it must be probably like $1, $2, probably.
Maybe, yeah. I want my cut.
Yeah. Steve also had some hot takes to share. He writes, I disagree that the length on TT1PD is justified. It starts off so exciting and the noise stabs get you pumped, but after 5 or 6 minutes, I find myself checking how much longer there is. The track doesn't go anywhere and it gets boring. Sure, it has a shift about halfway through, but even then it's using a lot of the same sounds. I think it has so much potential as a shorter track. He also writes, you mentioned that All End seems entirely composed with what you described as tape artifacts added. Though that may be true, it sounds like a live recording to me where they slowly turn knobs and periodically turn parts down to produce that tape effect. You mentioned the reaction to the silence after All End is finished. Once the noise cuts out, you get this strange sensation of emptiness. I think Autechre was teasing that feeling with the random tape effect. Personally, I thought it was kind of a cheap gimmick and somewhat lessens the All End experience. Thoughts on either of these hot takes here?
You know, with the TT1PD thing, you know, that's one of the best things about NTS. If you didn't like that one, there's 7 hours and 50, you know, more minutes to choose from.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about that, you know, with NTS and LSEC. You know, there's kind of something for every Autechre fan in there. You're probably not going to love all 8 hours of it. And I you know, I think that's one thing that makes, you know, those sets, you know, so wonderful. As for All End, I don't really think it's a cheap gimmick. I'm not sure if it's just a added effect or if it's like, you know, the listener mentioned. But it doesn't cheapen anything to me. I think it's pretty neat. I assumed that maybe it even, you know, they recorded it to tape and it's a legitimate, you know, artifact.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, with TT1PD, I think it is remarkable how it's basically like a heater all the way through. And it's like 20 minutes long. It's like crazy how long it is. And, you know, I do think it's significant, actually, that it does sort of shift. I know it's a lot of the same sounds, but it makes this like shift into kind of like slower, heavier territory for really like the entire last half. And I think it couldn't have kept up the momentum that it has in the beginning. And I actually feel like that shift is what keeps it interesting for that entire 20 minutes for me. You know, when it comes to All End, I feel like listener Steve and I are like getting the same things, but I just like that what he's describing, sort of like it is like, I don't want to use the word cheap gimmick, but there's just something about it that is like so deflating that I love about it, because like when it cuts out it just sounds huge, you know, and when it's cutting out and then when it just sort of flickers away, like it just evaporates like into nothing at the end, you're just like, I don't know, I'm just like struck by like how artificial the whole thing was. I mean, I agree, it sounds like a live recording with like genuine tape artifacts, and it kind of gives you that just interesting like distance. Like I'm not listening to music, I'm listening to a recording of the music, and then the recording just evaporates and the music's gone, and there's something that kind of profound about that for me, like almost the, you get what I'm saying at all, like the distance, yeah, between like the hugeness of that sound but then the kind of like flimsiness of it.
Yeah, I get it. You know, I mean, sure, it's probably, you know, if you, it is probably a gimmick. You know, a gimmick's not necessarily bad. So if you like the gimmick, you're going to dig it. And if you don't like it, you know, I can see both points, basically. I'm on, yeah, your side. I enjoy it.
Yeah. All right. What's next?
Yeah, from listener Joe, they say, in response to Gabe overthinks about NTS4, LSEC came before it and completely broke formats and wasn't a complete success. And I think NTS was a reaction to this. It actually adhered to formats far more strictly than LSEC, aside from whatever an LSEC is. Also, given that Sign and Plus ended up being traditional album releases, I have a hard time believing that this is what they had in mind. I very much enjoy the theory, though, as I enjoy all of yours.
Yeah, so I mean, if you don't remember, I like kind of, I want to say half joking. I just don't know if I fully believe it, but I was kind of thinking like, okay, the NTS sessions like has this kind of narrative, this meta narrative to it where it's like, it's so strict about its formatting. It's like vinyl, you know, it's 20 minute sides of vinyl. It's a radio show, but then it sort of like opens out into NTS 4 where like it kind of strips free of all format limitations or something and turns into like this hour long, you know, thing, that only works in digital really. Again, I don't know if I fully believe that, but like the one thing that we didn't add to that conversation here is that, you know, with Sign and Plus, they've obviously really gone like totally into the like the traditional album kind of format again. Maybe this is something we'll save and talk about more, but it's like, if the idea is that, okay, LSEC was it wasn't as successful as it could have been because of the like lack of limitations, and NTS was some kind of reaction to that where they were like, you know what, we kind of like the format limitations and we like playing with those, then like our Sign and Plus kind of evidence that they had decided after LSEC that, yeah, we do like the stricts, you know, the strictures of physical format.
Yeah, maybe, because I agree. You know, NTS, and I think we talked about it, like NTS, I think works better than LSEC because of those, you know, kind of limitations and stuff. And I mean, so it could definitely be that, you know, like maybe LSEC, you know, was a bit of a, you know, failed experiment in that sense. And so they went back to, you know, normal with Sign and Plus. It also might just be, you know, Autechre doesn't seem to be one to repeat themselves. You know, if they release another, you know, 8 hour, 6 hour, 4 hour, you know, whatever, like album, people would be saying, oh, you know, that's their thing now, you know, that's what they do. And so I think like releasing 2 1-hour records, is in a way like subverting expectations again, even though it's kind of back to normal, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's key, honestly, because like you really got to be into the minutiae of Autechre, like is listening to a podcast, you know, every week about it, to recognize NTS as like this re-embracing of format, because for everybody else in the world, like all the Pitchforks and all the whoever's, NTS was like an 8 hour thing. Like,
exactly. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like the most mind blowing, like, holy shit, they don't give a shit about anything anymore. They're just like releasing as much music as they want. So for the rest of the world, the non like Autechre obsessives, Sign and Plus being like traditional album, like was like a shock. It was like as much of a shock as NTS being 8 hours, you know?
Exactly. So, it's another like being normal is a subversion. Yeah. For that. Yeah. Exactly. So 100%.
I feel like, you know, and if the 1/6 thing and the whole way NTS was rolled out is anything to go by, I'm starting to realize that Autechre likes to, you know, kind of troll a little bit, like just like, you know what I mean? Like just kind of make you think like they're going to do one thing and then do the opposite. And so I feel like they were speaking to a wider audience that was expecting like another 8 hour, maybe even 16 hour album with the surprise of Sign and Plus. But we'll definitely talk more about that next week. All right, we got more emails about what to do after we finish discussing everything Autechre. Our listener Steve recommends Aphex Twin, Pansonic, Clark, Coil, Speedy J, Bogdan Rosinski, Venetian Snares, Wisp, Quebris, I don't know how to pronounce that, I've honestly never heard of it, and Mike Paradinas. He also adds, you may also consider a record label. I have been very impressed with Analogical Force the past few years. Planet Mew would be another. I don't think either label has a bad release, though that may be a controversial opinion. Another idea would be to select IDM/experimental records you consider either classics or modern classics and do a deep discussion on those. Listener Harmon suggested Craven Faults, and listener Joe wrote, could you give us a small update on your post-final album plans? You mentioned doing an episode on the Gescom discography, but perhaps you could consider splitting it into at least a few parts. Are you still planning on doing an episode on the Hafler Trio Autechre collaborations and also one on the Warp Tapes? You know, I don't know. First off, you have any thoughts on any of these new artists that got mentioned? Anything sort of jumped to mind?
No, I think other people have mentioned Pansonic, and I've said, you know, that's one I would definitely enjoy. You know, Venetian Snares, I think someone said that, and we kind of agreed that it's maybe a little too samey, but, you know, it wouldn't be all that fun. Everybody else I either, you know, not a huge fan of, or you know, some of those I do not know, like that Hubris one we couldn't pronounce.
But it's definitely intriguing kind of to maybe do a label or
I was gonna say
isolated classics or something like that.
A label definitely seems interesting. You know, isolated classics, you know, something like that. I mean, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, but I mean, on that note, this is like a ways down the road, we do appreciate getting all the recommendations, and you know, we're definitely giving it a lot of thought, what to do. But that is later. And so, you know, to address like listener Joe's question at the end here, I mean, basically what I want to say is like we're gonna hash this out very soon. Obviously, we have to do it very soon, but like, I think we should try to make like a little schedule or something of, you know, so listeners like know what we're doing and can follow along. But the idea would be to, yes, like Gescom, maybe that's like a 2-3 episode series or something where we kind of do like all of Gescom. Maybe the Hafler Trio thing is like one bigger episode on its own, you know, like Warp Tapes, I think deserves an episode. Mm-hmm. But you know what I'm saying? Like, we'll break, you know, we'll do like probably an episode, probably two, maybe even three episodes like on the remixes. And then we mentioned before kind of like maybe even replacing like as the bonus episodes that we've been doing, like doing some more fun stuff like top 10 tracks or, you know, like in between some of these like missing pieces. That's kind of my thought.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're having fun doing this. So it's not like we're in any sort of rush to get through Autechre. If we stall enough, maybe they'll release something new.
Yeah.
I intend to milk it for all it's worth. I mean, we still really have a lot of stuff that we haven't talked about. You know, there's tons of remixes. Yeah. There's these Hafler Trio things, which, I mean, to be honest, like the Hafler Trio collabs and guest comment stuff, we're not like incredibly familiar with those. So, you know, as we start to listen to them, you know, maybe it'll be more interesting than we, you know, expected it to be or something. And we may split them into more episodes. You know, I think people maybe think we're more professional than we are. We really like don't plan that far ahead. But I agree. I think we should maybe try so that people, can follow along a little bit.
Yeah, we want to be able to like by next episode to give you a little heads up about, you know, some of these like major chunks that we're gonna go through, and then we'll do some like fun stuff in between. But you know, fear not, we will give each of these like important pieces, I think, to understanding like Autechre's trajectory. We're gonna give them their due. But all right, we better wrap it up there. Another much longer than I thought bonus episode. There were a few emails on top of that I'll save for next time, and a few parts of emails that we did talk about, which I'm saving as well. But I just want to thank you all once again for sending all these great comments in. And real quick, listener Tyler wrote in to say, I love having physically formatted media. I have all of the albums and EPs on CD, except for LSEC, of course. I have Incunabula, Amber, Triripte, NTS, Sign, and Plus on vinyl. I would buy the rest on vinyl immediately if they weren't so painfully pricey, and if Autechre got a slice of that cash. If there are any Warp reps listening to this podcast, please repress the rest. Just wanted to read that and put that out into the ether on the very long shot that there are any like Warp reps or anybody in charge of that shit listening to this. You know, please repress that shit.
Yeah, definitely. I would definitely buy them all. So that's at least two sales there.
Yeah,
so
there you go.
If you've got any Autechre opinions, hot takes you want to share, we want to hear them. Send them gonkcastpod@gmail.com. Next episode in a week. Sign in plus. Again, send us your thoughts, gonkcastpod@gmail.com. If you like the show, help us out, subscribe, leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast. Look us up on YouTube. Stay connected, Twitter, Instagram. Those are @gonkcastpod. And we'll see you next time.
See you. Yeah.